giving just some bullet outlines on the book of Daniel, and Paul and Brian are passing that out. This doesn't take the place of an in-depth study, and some of you will probably still want to take notes. There's some pencils up here if you want something to write with. But it just gives you a brief bullet outline of some of the significant things in...
You can say one per person.
Yeah, I made 100. I know we got plenty. And last night we started with the introduction and chapter 1, so I'll just briefly touch on that. Tonight I hope to be able to get through chapters 2 and 3. Then tomorrow night we'll touch on chapters 4, 5, and 6, and then Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday nights we'll get into the last 6 chapters, which are primarily prophecy. I'll try to pause as we go for questions, but if you've got a question and I haven't paused, you ask it at that time, because that's when it'll be the most meaningful. The book of Daniel is one of my favorites. It's one of the great studies in the New Testament. It has Old Testament miracles, dreams, visions, and drama, and it has messianic prophecies. It's been called, as I said last night, the Old Testament Revelation. And really, if you're going to understand the book of Revelation, you need to understand the book of Daniel. Because what Daniel does and what the book of Revelation do is to a large extent deal with four Gentile empires. And Daniel deals with the first three and only merely mentions the last. The book of Revelation deals primarily with the last one, the Roman Empire. If you've got the handouts now, I'll just go down the front page. Some of you will find page 2 is on the back of the front page. Others of you will find it's just on a separate page. But I trust your ability to find it. Under the introduction, we said last night that the book of Daniel covers a time frame of approximately 70 years. From 605 BC, when Daniel was taken captive, until we lose track of him, and probably at about the time of his death, 535 BC, when he would have been in the neighborhood of 85 to 90 years old. The book can be outlined into two main categories. Chapters 1 through 6 are primarily the history of Daniel's life with some prophecy. The last 6 chapters are primarily the prophecy of things yet to come. Daniel was taken captive in the first of 3 captivities. Ezekiel was taken captive in the second siege, and then, of course, the temple was destroyed in the third siege. So several prophets were concurrent or contemporaries. Daniel, who wrote and lived primarily in the city of Babylon. Ezekiel, who was a captive of the Babylonians, but apparently lived more outside of the city and wrote. And Jeremiah would have been a contemporary of Daniel's and Ezekiel's in Jerusalem before he was probably taken to Egypt when Jerusalem was destroyed. Some of you enjoy history and will want me to give more history than I'm going to give. Some of you don't enjoy history and wish I wouldn't give as much as I will give. So just bear with one another. We'll try to do a little bit of both. Yes?
Am I thinking incorrectly? Wasn't Belshazzar's feast the fall of Babylon about 536?
I have it about 539 when Cyrus comes in. 539, I think, was when the Medo-Persians came in. That's my understanding, Tom. He did live into the Medo-Persian Empire a few years, maybe 4 or 5, possibly a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Okay. But even, Tom's point is correct, but even when he was under the Medo-Persians, he was in the country that we would call Babylon, even though it was no longer under the Babylonian Empire because it had been captured. The book is written in both Hebrew and Aramaic. chapters 1 and the first few verses of chapter 2 are Hebrew, and then chapters 2 through 7 are Aramaic, and then it reverts back to the Hebrew, and that's one of the few times you see that in the Bible. Chapter 1, last night we talked about how the Babylonian values, the world values, were shown. Remember when they brought them in, they were looking for fair young men who were attractive, intelligent. Remember I made the comment, if you're smart and have good looks, you've got it made. Well, it was that way back then. We talked about the significance of the name changes, how Daniel and his three friends all had names that included a suffix that was part of Jehovah or El Shaddai. And the change was to make them into Babylonian entities. Daniel stood up and said no, however, and in essence, verses 8 and 17, I believe, are the key verses of Daniel chapter 1. Verse 8 says, Daniel determined not to defile himself, and verse 17 in chapter 1 talks about how that God gave these young men, and Daniel in particular, a great amount of wisdom. Okay, any comments or questions on anything we covered last night before I now move into the following chapters? Okay. In chapter 2, we have our really kind of first introduction. We've been introduced to Nebuchadnezzar, but we really begin to see this man in kind of a slice of life. Nebuchadnezzar is given more time or print in the Bible than any other pagan ruler, by far. No other pagan ruler is given as much press, if you want to use that term, as Nebuchadnezzar. And he was the first Gentile ruler to interrupt this Judean kingship. You remember the southern kingdom, after it split from Solomon under Rehoboam, remained relatively intact in Jerusalem until it was finally demolished and taken away in 586 B.C. by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the children of Israel were in captivity for 70 years. I think you're familiar with this. 45 of those 70 years were under Nebuchadnezzar, so he was by far the most dominant. And an additional 17 years would have been under Belshazzar. So roughly 62 of those 70 years of their captivity would have been under either Nebuchadnezzar or Belshazzar. And Belshazzar was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, even though in the text it calls him his father. In the Hebrew language, they don't have words for father and grandfather. So when it gets translated father, it simply means ancestor. And when it gets translated son, it just means descendant of. And that's why you might notice when you go to the lineage of Christ, it says such and such begot such and such. Sometimes they skip a generation or so in there. And it was just their way of looking at it. So Belshazzar, who we'll see a little bit later, is the one that sees the handwriting on the wall, was actually Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, but they accounted for 62 of the 70 years in which the children of Israel were in captivity. Nebuchadnezzar ruled from approximately 606 to about 561. And I say approximately, not because we didn't know when he ruled, but these kings tended to co-rule. And Nebuchadnezzar co-ruled with his father, Nebuchadrezzar, for several years until his father then left the scene. So it depends on really when you say he started ruling. Did he start ruling as they co-ruled, or did he start ruling as his father left the scene? I tend to look at it primarily in the latter, looking at the co-rulership as a little bit more of an apprentice. Nebuchadnezzar was almost a fearless man, as we're going to see in chapter 2, but one thing made him tremble. Chapter 2, verse 1. And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep break from him. Nebuchadnezzar could conquer all of the worlds, but he couldn't conquer his own dreams, and it troubled him. And I think there's probably a lesson for us to observe here. When men rise to leadership, it oftentimes brings a tremendous case of paranoia and insecurity, and you see this in the life of Nebuchadnezzar as we go through this. Nebuchadnezzar, I would say, would be a man who fulfilled the words that we find written in Job chapter 7, verse 14, when Job says to God, "Thou scarest me with dreams and terrifies me with visions." That's exactly the position Nebuchadnezzar found himself in. Chapter 2 follows chapter 1, obviously, but it follows it fairly closely, probably within a year or two. Probably within a year or so, chapter 2 follows chapter 1. Now, this is not always going to be the case. For instance, I think there are probably 15 to 20 years between chapters 2 and 3 when we get to that. And by the time we get to Daniel in the lion's den, we can see that Daniel was probably in his mid-80s by then. So these chapters tend to be chronological through the first six chapters. However, they're not always close. It's interesting to note that in chapter 2, we have one of the great dreams and one of the first great dreams about the Gentile empires. But this was not the first time that God spoke to pagan leaders in dreams. You might remember in Genesis chapter 20, verse 3, God came to Abimelech in a dream. God came in Judges chapter 7 to the Midianites in a dream. So this was not unprecedented that he would come to a pagan king. And some commentators think that maybe this was an indication to the Jews of just how far they had fallen. Okay. Just don't know how much of that to include and still make sure we've got time to do it. The main thing that we want to do in chapter 2 is understand this vision. So I'm going to jump down and spend a little time on Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and then as time permits, we'll go back and pick up some of these additional things. But if you have your Bibles, turn down or look down to verse 31 of Daniel chapter 2. For many of you, this is going to be a review, but it's such an important vision that we just must understand it, because if we don't understand chapter 2, we're not going to understand chapter 7, and if we don't understand chapters 2 and 7, we've missed out on 17% of the book. Daniel chapter 2, verse 31 is Daniel's recalling to the king of what his dream was. "Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before you, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest..." Well, let me stop there. In those verses, we have the vision of this image, and you will remember that the head was gold, and then as we moved down, we got to silver, and then we got to bronze, and then we got to iron. And we need to go down through and understand that this image was a prophetic vision of the Gentile world empires that were going to rule the world from the time of Daniel until into the time of Christ's coming. And if we turn over then to verse 38, we begin to see the interpretation of this vision. And whenever the Bible will comment and interpret on itself, we want to let it. Verse 38, "And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, the fowls of the heaven, that he hath given unto thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all, thou art this head of gold." Nebuchadnezzar, or the Babylonian Empire, was the head of gold. I'll just write that up here so that we have a clear remembrance of that. And it was the dominant world power at that time. In fact, at the time this vision was given, the Medo-Persian Empire was of little consequence. The Greek Empire and the Roman Empire were at best just little villages. But the Babylonian Empire, and I think it's appropriate that it was symbolized by gold, was one of the richest empires that the Lord had allowed to occur. And it was in domination from about 609 to 539 B.C. Those were the dominant years of the Babylonian Empire. Following that empire, and it's signified by silver, is the Medo-Persian Empire, which we will find a little bit later when we get to Darius and into the sixth chapter and so of the conquering of the Babylonians. They were the ones that came in under the wall when Belshazzar was having that feast and saw that handwriting. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but I know you're familiar with these stories, at least in to that extent. Daniel chapter 5, verse 28, and Daniel chapter 8, verse 20 give us the indication that what we're speaking of here is this Medo-Persian Empire, which had a longer life from about 539 to 334 B.C. Now we're going to see later in the book of Daniel the prophecy that indicates that the Persian aspect of this coalition was the dominant. And when we get to the seventh chapter, it will specify that. But let's just get an overview of the whole thing. Next we have this image is coming, and we've next got the bronze. Which stands for the Greek Empire, which was the next major empire to dominate the world. And, of course, we're most familiar with the Greek Empire under its charismatic and very successful, even though very short-lived, leader of Alexander the Great. The fourth one is iron. And the Bible never tells us what this iron empire is. But history demands, because there's just no other major empire to follow the Greek Empire, history just demands that, and I think almost everybody that has studied this agrees, that it was the Roman Empire. So we're taking ourselves all the way from the time of Daniel to the time of Christ. And to a large extent, the prophecies we're going to be looking at in chapter 7 through 12 are going back and putting more detail on this major prophecy that is outlined for us here in chapter 2. Now let's go just a little bit further, because this is not all that is seen. Let me go back where I quit reading into verse 34. Remember, as I was reading about this image, I stopped with verse 33. But now we have this image. It has a head of gold and works its way on down to where it has feet of iron and clay. And in Daniel chapter 2, verse 34, it says, "Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. And the iron and the clay, the brass, the silver, the gold, broke into pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away." Now drop down to verse 34 to get, or 44, pardon me, to get a little explanation. Now I can't draw, so forgive me. But we've got this image, in whatever form you want to imagine it, and we've got this stone that's being sent to break this image up. That's the visualization that we have here in chapter 2. Now this image, it's symbolic of these four empires that just followed one after another after another. And they actually covered approximately 1,100 years. The Babylonian roughly 600 B.C. to the end of the Roman Empire. And people will vary on this, but I happen to personally place the end of the dominant Roman Empire militarily at about 475 A.D., so you've got about 1,100 years that this covers, okay? But now we've got this stone, and we need to understand what this stone is. Verse 44 of chapter 2. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms and shall stand forever. The kingdom in verse 44 that God was going to set up is reference to the church. And he's saying that the kingdom, the church, will be victorious over all the kingdoms of men. And in fact, you can make a very good case that it was the church that led to the downfall of the Roman Empire. In very subtle, not in a military revolting way. We know that Jesus and God didn't want it done that way. Now bear with me and then I'll pause for questions. On verse 45, let's look at that. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands. Now that phrase, without hands, is extremely important because that means this is a supernatural stone. This wasn't a stone that man made. This was a stone that God made. It was without hands. As one poet said, man can make a brick, but only God can make a stone. And that's true. This isn't a brick. This isn't a man-made kingdom. And this isn't a man-made stone. This is a God-made stone. And this stone has reference to Jesus Christ, specifically. And it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, the gold. The great God hath made known to the king that what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation is sure of. Now what this dream and its interpretation was, in short, to cut through it, was that there would be four world empires, and ultimately they would all succumb to the power of God. They would all succumb to God's sending of His Son and the establishment of the church. Now the beauty of prophecy is none of this had even been thought of when this was done. This prophecy probably was given around 604 to 603 B.C. Still, almost 70 years before the Medo-Persian Empire, roughly, 270 years before the Greeks, and 550 years before the Roman Empire, if you place it at about 63 B.C., 600 years before Christ. And that's the beauty of the prophecy of God, is that it tells us things that are going to happen and then teaches us lessons. Now, I want to go back in a little bit and get some of the lessons that I believe come from this. But let me pause here, because I've talked for quite a while, just to make sure I got this covered, and see if you have any questions or comments you'd like to entertain before I go any further. Lowell.
One of your lessons is going to be that the kingdom did come, and that it wasn't for these flukes, like some people apparently think that Christ came and people weren't ready, so the kingdom didn't get established.
That comes right out of this. And let me make that over the mic. Lowell is referring to one of the doctrines that is proclaimed is that God never intended to establish the church, and He only established the church because the Jews rejected Jesus. So the church was an afterthought. That's that line of thinking. Well, this would certainly destroy that line of thinking, because verse 44 says, prophesies that his kingdom will be established 600 years before it was established. So that's a good point. That's a very good point. Marvin. Yeah, I think there's a lot of significance, and that's, well, I'll just go ahead and get into it. That was one of the two or three lessons I get out of this. What you have here is a devolution of value, symbolically. Gold is more valuable than silver, is more valuable than bronze, is more valuable than iron, and is more valuable than clay. It's just a circular devolution. And that's man. Man-made entities devolve rather than evolve. Thermodynamics demands that scientifically we devolve, but socially and morally and ethically, man devolves. And I believe it's showing this. Of all these kingdoms, even though we've heard of the Roman, probably the Babylonian was the strongest in its heyday. And I personally don't think man is getting better. I think man is getting worse. Not simply morally, I think genetically, I think intellectually. My personal opinion is Adam and Eve were smarter than you and I, because their gene pool hadn't yet been polluted with all of the mutations and disease and various things that have happened. Now, they didn't act very smart, I'll grant you that, but we don't always either. And in general, mankind doesn't. Very, very good point. I think that's one of the great lessons of this devolution, if you want to call it that. Anybody else? Comment or question? Okay, let me just go a little further. Another lesson that I get out of this chapter is that when you get down to the bottom, notice what this whole image is built on. It's built on iron and clay. The foundations of the kingdoms of men are built on weak and insecure and crumbling foundations. This image was top-heavy, and man's institutions are top-heavy. Man's institutions and man's government are built on the instability of human wisdom. Okay, anybody else? Okay, let's look at chapter 3 very briefly, and then maybe we'll have a little time for some comments after that. Chapter 3 is a chapter on idolatry. And man ultimately has to decide who he's going to serve, God or an idol. And that's what chapter 3 is all about. Yes, it's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and the fiery furnace. But the lesson in chapter 3 for us is, who shall we serve? One of the great needs that I believe we have and mankind has always had is people who do not change their beliefs based upon the circumstances they find themselves in. And that's exactly what we find here in chapter 3. Three young men who do not change their beliefs because of the circumstances they find themselves in. Now, it's a little bit ironic or a puzzle. Daniel's not mentioned at all in chapter 3. I can't tell you for sure why, but he must have been out of town, because he would not have bowed down to this image either. But this is a chapter about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the three friends of Daniel. The Septuagint indicates that chapter 3 takes place in the 18th year of King Nebuchadnezzar. If that's true, then by looking at chapter 2, verse 1, we know that chapter 3 takes place 17 years after chapter 2. And that's very, very likely, very, very probable. But Nebuchadnezzar had changed. Look in chapter 2, verse 47. Nebuchadnezzar answered unto Daniel and said, "Of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret." In other words, at the end of chapter 2, after Daniel had interpreted this dream, Nebuchadnezzar is saying, "You have really got the right God." Now in chapter 3, there's no talk of that at all. In fact, it's Nebuchadnezzar setting himself up as God. And how man changes as the clock rolls on. In these whatever years, 15 or 16 years, Nebuchadnezzar had forgotten, apparently, his allegiance or his confession of God in chapter 2 and was back to being the same old Nebuchadnezzar. Now, I want to notice a few things in here that I think are interesting that maybe you have or haven't taken a look at. This is a very distorted image. Look in verse 1. Distorted in terms of its ratios. Nebuchadnezzar, verse 1, king of an image, the king made an image of gold whose height was 70 cubits and the breadth was 6 cubits. So it was 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. Now that's a ratio of 10 to 1. For every cubit it was wide, it was 10 cubits tall. That's what I'm trying to say. Now, that's not natural for man. The average man has a ratio of about 5 to 1. And I know we all can find exceptions to that. But that's the average. Okay? It was a very skinny statue. That's what I'm trying to get at. Now, why it had this ratio, I'm not positively sure. But in the Bible, the number 6 is consistently the number for man. So this may be an indication that this image was an image, a man-made image. Okay? Man is always a little bit short. You remember in Book of Revelation when it talks about the beast, remember what the number of the beast was? It was the 666. Not always, but frequently, man was made on what? The sixth day. The number 6 and man just have this overriding commonality. I don't want to get too caught up in numerology because I think it can lead us astray, but I do think it's interesting. One writer said, when God converts a man, he moves him from a 6 to a 7. And 7's the number for perfection. Nebuchadnezzar built this idol, I believe, to one, try to unify his people in a religion, and to deify himself. To deify himself. Egomaniacs consistently try to manipulate the Bible. Let's just pick up a few additional things. Verse 4. Then a herald cried aloud. A herald is a paid preacher. That's exactly what a herald. It could have been translated a paid preacher. That's what that herald was. This was obviously a false preacher, but the herald proclaimed it. Verse 5. That at that time we heard the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, and all listing of the musical instruments, but it really wasn't in the deepest sense the musical instruments that were being blown here. It was Nebuchadnezzar blowing his own horn that we have here in chapter 3. Then we come to the three men that refused to bow down to this image. And if you were with us last night, we talked about Daniel's conviction and his ability to say no. You see now, probably about 18 years later, these three young men saying exactly the same thing. Verse 19. Then Nebuchadnezzar, full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed. This man just went berserk. He was furious against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace 1 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. Now this shows you that Nebuchadnezzar wasn't thinking straight, because if Nebuchadnezzar wanted to punish these three men, you don't make the furnace hotter. You cool it off. And you make them die slow and tortuous. He got this thing so hot, you remember that the people that threw him in died. But this just shows this man's mind was just totally berserk at this point, and rationale was not leading his thought process at all. And in fact, verse 19 said, we're talking about a very angry king, full of fury. Full of fury. God did not take the fiery furnace away from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego any more than he's promised to take our trials away from us. But what he did was give them a friend to see them through their trials. If you were going to ask me what I think the two main lessons from Daniel chapter 3 are, it's number one, we've got to just choose who we're going to serve. And number two, once we've chosen the Lord, He will always be there as a friend to see us through those trials. Look at the results of what happened here in this instance. The enemies of these three young men were executed. Verse 22. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent and the furnace exceeded hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We're going to see a similar thing in Daniel and the lion's den when Daniel's enemies, their families, and children were fed to the lions. Who can tell me the one thing that burned up in the furnace? Their bindings. These men were bound, and their bindings burnt. The only thing that I can find that burned up in the furnace were the things that bound these men, and they were liberated. When we go through trials with God at our side successfully, it's a liberating experience, because we find out that we're able to endure more than maybe we thought we could. The only thing that was burned were the bindings that Nebuchadnezzar had placed on these men. These men were encouraged. God didn't cool the fire, as I said. And these men's lives were insured. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had several surprises in chapter 3. One surprise was that the men of God were freed and not burned. A second surprise was that they were walking and not lying down. When they looked in, they saw four and not three. And through it all, God was exalted. Look at verse 15. These young men were sure that God was going to deliver them. And now if you be ready, that at the, what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, the psaltery, the dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the image which I have made. But if you worship not, you shall be cast the same hour into the midst of the burning fiery furnace, and who is that God that shall deliver you? Nebuchadnezzar was taunting them. Who do you think is going to deliver you? But look at verse 29. After this has all happened, Nebuchadnezzar comes back to a brief union with God and says, therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, language would speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made of dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. Almost identical to the kind of praise we saw him giving in chapter 2 after the dream. And Nebuchadnezzar is just a microcosm of man. We draw near to God, Then we fall away. Then something happens and we draw near. And we're not done seeing Nebuchadnezzar draw near and then fall away. Okay, let me pause a little bit and see if you have any comments or questions you'd like to make on the third chapter particularly, but on either one of these chapters. Clark.
Verse 18 is very good. Those men did not know that God saved them by fire and furnace. They even said that we are not going to serve you anyway.
That's right. These men had no guarantee that God would save them, but they were going to do it anyway. Because they had faith that even if they died, it would be better for them than to bow down. Very good. Very good. Anybody else? If I don't see your hand, just speak up.
The same society, people of the same society that a few years before had been worshiping idols.
Repeatedly. Repeatedly. Absolutely. Anybody else? Dwight.
I love thought on that gold.
Yeah.
And silver and stone.
Uh-huh.
We know that that gold and silver brass will melt down, or bronze, but you ever see stone melt down?
No, certainly not as easily. And I don't, lava is a little bit different than pure stone, so your point's well taken. And certainly the stone, even though it wasn't as large, in man's observation, was more powerful, wasn't it? Was more powerful, absolutely. Good point, good point. Anybody else? Okay, I want to go back and make a few comments on this stone, because this is a... I want to go back and make a few comments on chapter 2. I guess that's really what I want to do. This iron and clay is an interesting mixture. Iron is strong and clay is weak. And the mixture of those two creates something that's weakened because of the clay. The iron, I think, pardon me. The iron may well be symbolic of authority as well, and might, and the clay of something much weaker, i.e. people. And at least it's my view that what we begin to have in this devolution is that the people begin to have an increasingly greater say in the civil government. Now, what I'm going to say is going to go a little bit contrary to what most of us believe, and I am glad I live here, and I'm glad I live in a democracy, but I just want you to think this through. A democracy is not a very efficient way of governing. That's why God didn't set His kingdom up as a democracy. When the church gets together to decide what should be done on spiritual matters, we don't vote and majority doesn't rule. We go to the Scripture and the Scripture rules. Because democracy is not a very good way of governing. And we're seeing in this country what happens when people learn that they can have the authority. They begin voting themselves money in all kinds of ways, and that's part of the reason for the mess we're in. A benevolent dictatorship, if you will, is probably the most effective way to govern. The problem is you don't always get benevolent dictators. You oftentimes get malevolent dictators, and that's not good. But we in America sometimes get in our heads that democracy is the best form of government and it's the only way to go. It's not the best form of government and it's not the only way to go. Because if it were, then God would have established the church that way. Now, I don't mean that as an un-American sentiment, and I'm certainly thankful I'm here. I just want to jog our thinking a little bit. Much was done under these kingdoms. Probably no one's going to come close to doing what Alexander the Great did in his short life. And it was whatever he said you did. Let's not think about it. You know, it was a very militaristic type of an approach. And I can get on my soapbox here, and that's not going to do any good, but except make me feel better. But when we need an efficient form of doing things, there has to be a high degree of authority. There has to be a high degree of authority, and that's why Jesus is our authority. And we see many religious organizations that I believe are beginning or have begun or are already being run in a democratic fashion. And it does not work. Now, on non-doctrinal issues, yeah, do you want to add a classroom? That's not what I'm talking about. But it's not a democracy. And this iron and clay really starts to fall apart. And I think it's because people get into this democratic mindset.